Guten Abend, liebe Gäste, liebes Publikum.
Good evening, guests, audience. I'm really thrilled to be sitting here with four people without whom Archive of Refuge would not have happened. I've got Manuela Bojadjev, Caroline Emke, then Mohamed Sarangi and Eddie Spekonia, I hope I've said that correctly, she says. And it would be worth introducing each of them in a great deal of detail, but we've only got a very short amount of time. And so I just want to tell them a bit about what they were doing in this actual project. I'm sure they've all won so many awards, and that's all of great interest, but I'm going to leave all of that out because we don't have a great deal of time. But you can read up about them if you want to, and you know where you can find out more if you want to. So forgive me sitting on the sofa. So just very briefly, alphabetically, Manuela Bojadjev is a migration professor, and that's a very brief description of what she actually does. Together with Caroline Imke, she curated this project and carried out many of the interviews. Caroline Imke is a co-curator, and she and Manuela initiated it all based on her idea. It was her idea that we have this archive. So I'm going to ask her more about that as well. Mohamed Sarangi is a historian and carried out a number of interviews as well. Isn't that true? And you're a legal expert. Legal expert? No, I mean, I have many strings to my bow, but I'm not a legal expert. I mean, add it. You know, I'll quote you. Oh, God, it's in the program that you're a legal expert. But there we are. You're certainly a historian, aren't you, though? You are. And you carried out lots of the interviews, so that's true. And that's also written down somewhere in the context with this project, that you were the guardian angel of the whole thing. So maybe I can say that, and you can't deny it. Okay. And Haida Spekonia is a filmmaker, and she filmed the interviews. And so it's her concept, the aesthetic concept is hers. And I'm Verena Lücken. I'm a journalist. I was not involved in the project. So what are we going to be talking about this evening? We're going to have a studio talk here in the sense that we're going to look in the engine room of the whole thing. So, Caroline, you had the original idea to have an oral history of these experiences. And I remember when you first introduced it, you talked a bit about the financing as well. What I'd like to know is, how did this idea come about? Because at the time, it must have been 2015, because you worked on this project for 5 years. And at that time, everybody talked about people fleeing their homes, and lots of people wanted to do something. But you said, I want to have an archive. So how did that come about? Well, I'm sure there are plenty of people in this room here saw these images, saw the situation in 2015, and I think many of us had this urge to do something. And then we sort of all have different capacities or different institutions that we work with or different professions or disciplines. And in this context, I felt that it had to do with having a really good circle of friends who, you know, that it's just like a group of smart alecks who from different disciplines. And there were lots of people in my circle of friends who had to various different degrees worked or had contact with, you know, migratory flows with people who'd fled their homes. And I think the most important thing for this whole project was from the initial desire to do something and the initial idea of what we wanted to do, what we could do, and thinking it could be an archive, was to pull the speed out of the whole thing, to slow it all down, deaccelerate. That was perhaps the most important decision in the 5 years, is to say, look, let's take the time to think about exactly what we want, what it would need, what disciplines, what perspectives, what skill sets we would need to do it well. And maybe I can say that, you know, for a year and a half, we didn't do anything except think about the concept and develop it. So a year and a half, we didn't do a single film. We didn't have a single interview. We didn't even meet anyone or encounter anyone that we wanted to interview. All we did was think about how we wanted to do it, who we wanted, how we could elicit their stories from them, how to interview, what sort of time frames. Manuela will say more about that perhaps. And I think this decision to take the time, to take that much time to develop it, I would say from my perspective, you know, 5 years down the line, that was the most important decision. Now, Manuela, you as a co-curator, you also worked on the guidelines for the interviews. So was that something that came up within the framework of these workshops that you were thinking about for such a long time? And what were the traps? I could imagine, you know, the people that you interviewed are ones who, over the course of their lives, would have had to tell these stories again and again, you know, as asylum officials would have asked them their stories at the border, they'd have to ask their stories. So you had to find a new way of talking to them that wasn't like that. Yeah, I mean, it's an oral history project, and I'm not a historian, unlike Mohammed. Well, he isn't one. No, I am a historian, just not a legal expert. Oh, my God, I'm so embarrassed. I got it wrong. Yes. And I'm not a legal expert either, says Manuela. But the guidelines were, you know, took a long time for us to develop because we thought long and hard about exactly what we wanted to do here, namely to create an archive of refuge in the singular and to put this together that on the one hand would be able to bring together all of these very different histories that have hardly got any common denominator, and then how to present it. I mean, there was a great deal of knowledge in our group about migration, about flight and refuge and history. And I think we sort of pooled this knowledge to try to understand certain aspects that I think required very different discipline and maybe political and aesthetic issues and brought them all together. So an example might be, we had someone who really did do legal report. That was Inke Stern. And we had someone who came from the medical trauma research on migratory flows and people fleeing their homes as well, the sort of trauma side of fleeing your home. And then I've done racism research, for example, so I was interested in knowing what is the logistics of flight, of leaving your home. What are the components? How do you finance it? Things like that. And so we brought together lots of different issues and components through a method, and that'll bring me to my last point. The method of starting when people were born and ending where they are now in the present day. And I think this has a real advantage, and it also helped our methodology so that you don't reduce people to this period of their life where they fled their homes, even though it's an archive of refuge. Can I just ask, in this guideline for the discussion, the interviewers had space to deviate? Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. I mean, they all did it very differently. So it wasn't a catalogue of questions. Yes, it was a catalogue of questions, but we were able to tweak it depending on the situation of the dialogue. And I think we focused on different areas in our interviews. So, for example, at the very beginning, we were thinking we would all ask the same questions, and then there would be a comparable element to the interviews. We gave up with that very quickly because we understood quickly that the histories and stories require different focus areas. Can I just add a thing? And just to explain that, I just wanted to say that, yes, we did develop a guideline, but it was intended as a sort of banister, through the interview, sort of a stable dramaturgy. You know, first you tell the story of your childhood, how you grew up, describing the country they came from, the country of origin. So that would be the first section of the dramaturgy. Then there's a section about the actual flight, the journey. You know, someone maybe got on a plane and came here. Sometimes they were really, really short, and sometimes it was a long, agonizing story. So that was the sort of transition, the migration, the flight from the country of origin and then arriving here. So it was sort of a structure, the guideline, something that could be interest for research as well. Four questions of comparative aspects, things that are similar, but at the end of the day, you know, these are basically two people meeting and talking. And so, of course, they have the freedom to deviate from the guideline or to go a roundabout way to getting all this information or whatever like that. So, Mohammed Sarhangi, historian. Sorry. So, as a historian, though, you're familiar with all of the conditions that drive people to leave their homes in different historical contexts. So I understood that with you, the job was to sort of have contact with the people who were approached to interview or to get into an interview, and you had to sort of build up some kind of sense of trust so that they would be prepared to come and do the interview. How did you do that? And how is that connected with your knowledge of the political and geographical and historical situations? Thank you for that question. So first of all, let's say I came into the project because Caroline asked me if I wanted to do that. And of course I wanted to do that. And then I started. And I have to say that at the beginning, I didn't know exactly what my job was. So I had to invent what my role was. And I think what helped was, you know, meeting all these wonderful people and gaining their trust didn't have a great deal to do with my knowledge as a historian. I think it has had more to do with me as a human being and how I can approach people and how I do approach people and how I connect with people. And I think that my knowledge itself, I'm glad it's there, but I think it was more an emotional aspect. This work for me had a great deal more to do with emotions. And, you know, you have to imagine when I'm speaking today, there are two voices. Nadia Hellman is over there, and I worked with her primarily. And Nadia said something really nice because my job wasn't just finding people to interview. And at the end of the day, not convincing them, but requesting that they would enter into an interview with us, but also to support them during the filming, which happened right here on the stage. And Nadia said at some point, you know, because we went shopping together and we, you know, had this nice table. And Nadia said I was the host. And that's how I understood myself. I was like a host. And these people were my guests, which is why I tried to ensure that from the beginning to the end, they were happy with everything. Well, that's beautiful. Do you still have contact with any of them? I do. I have contact with a lot of them. I don't know who are here. Ranji, I can see back there. Hi. And who else is here? Nelly. Wow. There. Who else is here? Oh, there. Yeah, of course you are. Hajan, hi. You see? And for me, it was wonderful to see them all and to hug them. We all had our masks on. We did it all right, but we did hug. It was great. So what about you, Heidi Speconia? You're a filmmaker, and it was your job to shape it all for the shooting, the filming. And so it had to look sort of appealing for the interview partners. It was supposed to dismantle their fears, you know, calm them down. Camera's always a little bit worrying, isn't it? It makes you a bit shy. So, but at the same time, you didn't want it to be too private, but it also had to be the case so that when we come from the outside world and have a look at it, everyone sort of sticks to it. So there has to be a concept. So how did you develop that from your documentary film? So I think an important point is what Caroline was just saying, the factor of time. we really had that. It took time and we needed time because it was an incredibly complex project. And I don't think any of us had ever done it before. I mean, we all had experience in our own fields in a project in which, you know, with this sort, on this sort of scale, with this sort of concept, none of us had experience in that, of course. And here we really had an opportunity to sort of figure our way in. We practiced, we had workshops. And so we did put the teams together very carefully, because I think one thing that was very clear, and this has to do with the guideline. Of course, we had the guideline at that point too, when I joined it. But it became clear that it's not exactly an interview situation as such. It's not about asking the facts. These are going to be conversations between two people. And these two people shape this talk, this conversation, and both are part of the conversation. And that was a really important idea, to come up with a concept so that both sides feel respected. But at the same time, we knew that we're going to be working with a technique. You know, we're working with light, we're working with cameras, there are people behind devices, you know, there's a microphone dangling over you, there's a, you know, people have a cable. What do you mean when you say there's a microphone hanging over you? Is that, yeah, I'm just saying, like, you might have this sound. Some people, you know, have a lapel mic or whatever. Not everybody likes to have, you know, a mic stuck under their blouse or whatever, a lapel mic, you know. And the aim was to create a situation. I'm comparing it with a tent. You know, it's sort of like both people who are having this interview must feel as if they're protected, as if they were in a tent together through the situation. So that was a challenge. And there's also a really big difference of whether or not you're having an interview and you're just writing it all down, or if you're actually filming it. And these sort of emotional moments, making them possible for the emotions to unfold, to come up, and then to allow there to be a break, you know, when somebody's remembering something, to watch somebody remembering. We wanted it to sort of be part of the concept, but at the same time, we also had to make that possible too. And it was clear that we wouldn't be able to do that if we have a, you know, a team that's permanently changing. Everyone had to agree on this approach, this sort of human approach, and the technique.
Hatten wir wirklich Glück, dass wir.
And we were really lucky that I think we had four teams, didn't we, Nadia, in the end, over the 3 years of film work.
It was 3 years, and there's one thing I would like to add. The question was, earlier, how do you manage these conversations to be different from the interrogations and interviews that people have to go through at other times? And everything that we did across all levels, we have Stefanie Schüler-Schengorum, she contributed importantly from the very beginning on, and gave us the certainty about what is going to work, whether we are allowed to do so. Manuela was mentioned. Manny van Busch from the Charité Hospital gave psychological support and advice. So there were so many people who joined us in thinking about how can we manage to not reproduce the interviews and interrogations at the Federal Office of Migration. That was the central question. We didn't want to have a conversation where people feel tested, where people are being distinguished, the good and the bad ones, the legal and the illegal migrants. So we knew that these were the experiences people had gone through before. And this is something which determined the calmness, the flow of our conversation. That was a very important factor in putting together our guideline. We wanted to decide that when there are certain questions, you don't continue probing for further details in order to avoid that impression of an interrogation. And it was very important for Heidi Spekonia to have taken an aesthetic decision where we said we don't want to shoot our videos at where people live. That would have been a situation, that would have been an option, that would have offered some advantages, that would have allowed us to get to know more about the person. But there were many reasons against such an approach, because the person would not be alone, probably. There would be kids around, or their partner would be around. It's not clear how freely people can really tell their story. And the other reason, and we had that backdrop with which we generated an atmosphere, we said everybody should be in the same situation, in the same constellation. Some might still be in the official shelters where they don't feel good, and where they feel ashamed should they watch this video in 5 or 10 years' time. And that is something that you also put emphasis on. And if we see these videos and we watch these videos, for me, and you don't know how it's going to work out at that time, but it was a very important decision to be taken. Yes, it's 42 videos, and at home, in this context, is a problematic side. It's a problematic category, because you don't know where you will be when you are at people's home. Now, what I'd like to know about how you shot the video, before the final version, you edit a video, and there is this stereotype of all the material that would drop to the floor of the editing room. Editing a video is a curatorial intervention, isn't it? Or didn't you edit at all? Yeah, that was a decision that Caroline and Manuela took very early on during the project, that the conversations should be kept as they were. So we didn't... We could start with the very beginning, then look back at the childhood of people, but we wanted to follow the sequence of the conversation itself. And we didn't want to intervene unless at two junctures, when there was a break and the camera was switched off. That's where we cut it and we marked it with black frames, and we found it important to highlight that that's a cut. And the protagonists got the transcripts of the conversations and had the opportunity to check whether everything could be used, as it were. But the films, the videos didn't have to be approved. Only the transcripts were later approved by the protagonists. Let me add the following. Our protagonists, directly after the interview, were asked whether there was anything in that conversation where they had the feeling they wouldn't like that to be included. If there was such a moment, and that happened very rarely, in the very first, that was the very first moment for them to decide whether it should be published or not. And then when they talked about their life for 3-4 hours, they would go home and feel uncertain about something they told us. There might have been a passage where the protagonists weren't sure whether they wanted this passage to be included and stay included or not, and they sent us an email, respectively. And there was the option also, in addition to that, to read the transcript. And those who felt uncertain, and we had these cases also, set with us together in the editing room and followed how we edited the video. We thought of safety, but also thought of the good feeling of our protagonists. Those things that were not to be included were marked, as Heidi already said. So we wanted to create transparency. We wanted to show where we cut anything, but we didn't show what we cut. Yes, it's about cutting and editing, right? I'd like to remind you of the conditions under which we produced this archive. The point of departure was exactly how you described it, Caroline. It was the migration movement in 2015. And how do we want to respond to this situation? There was a wave of racism, the emergence of right-wing movements, which we experienced at that point in time. And we saw a discourse in media where the legitimacy of asylum was being questioned systematically. And all those decisions were taken against exactly this backdrop. We didn't want anybody to tell us that this material was edited in a certain manner to make it feasible for political ends. No, that's exactly an impression that we wanted to avoid. We wanted to create transparency, which was verifiable, and a blend of the other element, which was the central paradigm of this project. We wanted to provide a situation to people where they can trust us, and they have to trust us, and where we give them the opportunity to tell their stories. There is something else, if I may. Of course you may. That's all true and correct, but still, in spite of that, there is something that I would like to add. So we left the video as it was, with the exception of those junctures that were marked by the protagonists. And to be frank, the idea that you just intervene in a project of this type, I'm not talking about a documentary filmmaker, that you do something with your material, of course you do, but the very idea that you some way or other, you try to create a tension, did not fit, wasn't appropriate, would have been bizarre and absurd to do something like that. And I would even say that, of course, if we think of what we are accustomed visually, these are extraordinarily long conversations. Yes, there is hardly any conversation shorter than 2 hours. Yes, that's right. But I'm deeply convinced that only because they are so long, a lot of things were able to be narrated. Moments emerge, situations emerge about something that people didn't feel good talking about. And all of a sudden they crop up and become tellable, as it were. So being open, being patient, being calm, Heidi Spilkonia is just the point in case for being calm in other situations too. But it's good that the viewers can take part in that calmness, and people who have come here, we owe them a lot. And it's the minimum what we owe them is to just take the time and listen to such a conversation in its entire length. Do you know of comparable history projects which might have taken a similar approach, would have served as a guidance for you? Yes, that was one for me, but then again, we did it entirely differently. But what I had been thinking of was the Yale Fortune Archive of Holocaust testimonies. They also have conversations of extraordinary length and calmness, but it's not comparable. These are survivors of the Holocaust. And nobody was really interested in their story, and they started interviewing themselves mutually. So the origin was different. It was extended later on to other participants too. But our situation was entirely different. Although we had a very diverse team of interviewers, people amongst the interviewers, also with migration, history is the background, but that was a different aspect. Mohammed, I think it was 1986 when you came to Germany. How old were you at that time? 6 years old. But you're not part of this archive, and maybe your history is not a history of having to flee a country. Yes, my history is similar, but I'm not part of that, included in that archive, because I had a position there. I was on the organizing side. Now, did it help you, if I understand it correctly, you are one of the central point of contacts, persons of contact that people turn to, and you were the ones to identify the protagonists. Did you also tell your story? I mean, there's an imbalance. There is one who tells the story, there's another person who listens. There is an imbalance in this structure, per se. Was that an issue at all? Or, I didn't raise it as an issue. I didn't tell people, my name is Mohammed, and I've also got a history of having to flee my home country. That's not the case. It's something like street credibility, like Carolyn coined it at one time, and therefore it was just fitting. That was something that people could connect to and identify with. And I talked to many of the interviewees, and I told them. And I saw a lot of traits of my own family. It was a similar story, similar feelings for them. That was important. And what was also important, and I think it has been mentioned already, and it's something that Manuela mentioned in her opening speech, or in our opening talk, when we talked about what this project meant for me, for us, in the very beginning. I just finished my PhD and got my graduation as a PhD, and I thought, now the world needs to welcome me, and nobody welcomed me. And it was interesting to see that it's not the case. And through that job, I basically had to take myself out of the calculation of the equation. I had to step into the background. I noticed it's not about myself. And I learned a lot from the interviews about them, and I learned a lot about myself, which is something that I'm very grateful for. I'm grateful to these people before and behind the camera. I think it's different in your case, wasn't it? You didn't want to hold these interviews with people who didn't have the same background like you, right?
I mean, I don't have an experience of migration. Okay, I spent a year in England, but I was born here. But in my family, it's a bit different. But at the same time, I feel the way Mohammed was just saying as well, that I also had the feeling that this archive isn't about me. But of course, it's about something that's close to my heart. And I think that was a really important part in the way that many of these stories were sort of provoked by this archive into being talked about. Many of these stories are not ones where I would say, I knew that story. I knew it would be like that. Quite the opposite. I went into many of these talks and came out of it very different, because I learned so much about the conflict on this planet. You know, this situation where you sort of keep yourself out of it, but at the same time let the person speak in a protected, safe space. But at the same time, you have to ask some questions, but in a way that was clear to me, that the people have to tell the story so that they're explaining it for themselves. They're explaining it to us as well. I mean, many of the things that I might have known, I didn't express. But after we had the decision, when I was asked, you know, when you're asking me if there were certain talks I didn't want to talk about, it's true. I didn't want to interview people from former Yugoslavia, because I know that I would not have the kind of distance to be able to keep myself out of it that I wanted to have. I wanted to have that distance. I wanted to keep myself out of it. And I think that that was good for the quality of the talks. you know, that was always my feeling. It's not about me. It's not about me. And that's like what Muhammad was saying as well. Can I add something there? I think one aspect was that one thing that we haven't talked about is that, you know, Heidi Spekonia chose all of the teams who were there, and they were just, I mean, it wasn't just that they had an amazing feeling for it, but it was also they all contributed to creating this atmosphere. And you had a sense that, you know, the sound engineer was choked up just as I was choked up in the middle of a conversation. And that was fantastic, fantastic group of people chosen by Heidi. And maybe this was something that I wouldn't have had a good intuition for methodologically, you know, like, should you somehow choose, you know, should you sort of match and cast the interviewer to the interview partner or interviewee? I mean, you might have done it, you know, women interview women and people of color interview people of color and, you know, or like people with similar backgrounds, blah, blah, blah. You know, we could have operated that way. And at the end of the day, that did sometimes happen, that there was quite a lot of, you know, previous knowledge and context between the two, but there were also conversations where that wasn't there at all, but that also worked. So I think it had something to do with the fact that all of us coordinated how we wanted to talk, even if we didn't have a shared history or shared sexuality or whatever other similar characteristics we might have shared. You wanted to say something. Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, this question of closeness and distance, both in terms of the content, but also the history of the interviewer. But this was also something that continued in our setting here. And the question of how are we positioning the two people who are parties to this interview? How different do they have to be from one another? What distance, what closeness? And it's such a sensitive question because, you know, when you're positioning them, you want to be able to hear each other well. And as an interviewer, maybe you want to have someone close enough to comfort if they're not doing well in the interview. But at the same time, you want to give a person their space. And Eva Kirma was talking or asked me about that earlier on when she was saying the distance at which the two chairs were set apart from one another was exactly right. It fulfilled exactly what she was saying. It fulfilled exactly what she needed to do it. You know, and I tend to work in a very small team, and this in the House of Cultures of the World, there were 100 people. We didn't meet all of them. They were only involved later in the project. We didn't see them all. But the other thing is, in this project, that everyone could rely on the other person. You could trust. Everyone could trust everyone in the team. And we really generated a lot of knowledge over the 3 years to really create this project and make it happen the way we wanted to. And the last point, whether it really worked, whether this warmth really came across in this talk, that's something you only know when it's shown to an audience. And that's why it was so incredibly wonderful to experience that today, because wherever you were, there was always an encounter, whether it was between the doors or going down the stairs. And in my wildest dreams, I couldn't have imagined it being the way it was, but it really did work. You know, these conversations mix with the audience, with the space as well. Well, you know, one specific example, if I can just make it clear what we mean when we say, you know, how these interviewers and interviewees were matched. I mean, I think the youngest was maybe early 30s, and the oldest interviewer was almost 75. So those are very, very, very different references in these groups, different religious, cultural, linguistic contexts. Just to give you one example that showed me very clearly how important it was to have this diversity, there was a conversation between Nadia Salzman, definitely worth watching, and the interviewer was Gabriela von Arnim. And there's one scene in which Nadia Salzman is talking about her first or her second husband. I can't remember. And Gabriela von Arnim is sitting opposite her and says, "And what was he like?" And it's totally clear that as a much younger woman, I would never have dared to ask this woman who's older about this. You know, and then these two women are talking about, you know, well, he was a Russian. Well, what do you mean he was a Russian? Well, you know, he drank a lot, you know, come on. And you just get a sense that this is a conversation that if any one of us would have interviewed, it would have been a totally different conversation. Although, of course, you know, there were this sort of dramaturgy and the guideline gives you this sort of structure, right? A sort of banister taking you along, something to hold on to. But I think that that was part of the sort of wealth, the richness that both created. It created the fact that there were very, very individual groups of interview and interviewee, or pairing of interview and interviewee. But at the same time, there are enough structural similarities so that they're useful for, you know, research or academic work or whatever. They could be important there too. Just two questions, if I may. The one is, you know, Sasha Mariana Salzman was here exactly where you're sitting now, just now, and in the previous talk, and she was talking about the narrative, you know, stories that she invented about herself. She referred to that idea. Did that play any role? Did you sort of factor that in? That, you know, were questions of authenticity, because you're saying research is an option here, that this is one that you couldn't possibly assess or wouldn't want to assess in terms of veracity or authenticity. Can I answer that? Well, we're basically assuming that people told us their story. Of course, that has, you know, two meanings, that sentence. And of course, we always know this from our own lives as well, that certain memories are told in a certain way, depending on who you're talking to. I mean, certain experiences are considered by us to be incredibly important and others not so important, you know. And I think conversations like this provoke and create certain issues becoming really important. And the guideline is great as a banister because it does it, you know, in a whole range and not just focusing on when people fled their homes and that whole journey and that experience. So that's why it is really important, I think, to have this focus. I would say, of course, you know, naturally, these are stories, they're narratives. And as stories and narratives, they contain, you know, mistakes, errors, gaps, fragments. And they don't, you know, sometimes they're a bit circular, you know, or they jump back and forth in time, like all of us do in any oral history project. It's like that, isn't it? You know, it's not, what do we say in television? You don't do a fact check on these interviews, as they say in TV today. Of course, this is the way it was. And that's why it was so interesting to have different generations asking the questions and responding, because sometimes while they were talking, people were saying, oh, I know, I'm not even sure if what I'm telling you now is the experience of my parents or if it's my own experience. You know, and I'm sure that we could all say that when we were telling, if we were telling our story. It wasn't something specific to these people, but they are narratives. They are stories. Of course they are. And there's one point over the course of this project that became a sort of something we were thinking about methodologically, because we had to think about the transcriptions. And in many of the interviews, translation or interpretation played a role as well. So we didn't always speak the same language when we were carrying out the interviews. So the person who was interviewing might not have spoken the language of the interview partner. And that meant that there was a mediator in between. So there was an interpreter in between who maybe didn't quite understand the name of some locality, some city or something. And there we did some research in the transcription. We didn't do a fact check as such, but we definitely did check, is this translation the correct translation of that city, of that place, or what's mentioned? Now, archives aren't usually closed entities. Is this an open archive? Could you imagine, or is it even planned for it to continue? I would say we can't do anything without Mohammed, and probably not without Nadia too. So it'll depend on them. No. I mean, for reasons of strength, time, energy, etc., I think, you know, the ones that we have are people who are in Berlin, Brandenburg. They're sort of in the area. Of course, you could always expand that. And in other cities, in other regions in Germany, teams could form as diverse as possible who could work with this format. I mean, you have to sort of say, you know, it would be ideal if these talks followed our setup here, the way we did it. But of course, if these things emerged in other places, I mean, the website, Nadia, correct me if I'm wrong, but it could technically be expanded, couldn't it? I guess it could. So there's a wonderful idea for everyone who's sitting in this room to maybe go away and create something similar.
5 Jahre, genau.
So that's a project for the next 5 years. And it's now 5 minutes before 10, which is the moment where we should stop, unless, Ahmed, you want to say something. Yes, there's something that I'd like to add regarding the team and the shooting of the video. Our cameraman, Thomas, is also here with us. It was a great film team, and one of the producers is not here. We talked briefly, and she said it was a family-like situation. This team just worked like a family, and this project was just like a large family project. Well, we're not going to go into detail here. Thank you. Thank you very much. It was so interesting. Thank you for listening. I think Carolyn wants to say something about tomorrow's program. Yes, right. I prepared a leaflet where all the information had been put on about what's going to come up tomorrow, but I don't have that sheet with me. But you can read it up in the agenda, and don't tell anybody that I lost this sheet. It's a fantastic program. We've got a keynote, Norbert Frey. The historian is going to hold a keynote speech, and after that we're going to have a discussion between Stephanie Schüler-Springorum and myself. And then we have Mohammed again, and then it will be your turn. Not my turn. Oh, is that true? History and representation. It's the first panel on history and representation will be held by Stephanie Schüler-Springorum. And then later in the evening, there is a high-level panel on history and representation with Ute Filbert. It's too late. So, it's too late for that. There was an interjection by somebody from the audience. Have a nice evening then.